This is the Nobel Podcast, where we talk about how to optimize your technology, life, and mind. We're joined by special operations veterans, entrepreneurs, investors, and others who have overcome difficulty to make it to the top of their craft by staying in the fight. What is your name?
Yeah, name's Dustin.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in East Tennessee. It's primarily a manufacturing town. It's a big church-driven community too, so a lot of Southern Baptists. And it's like all in the same mix. You got the Methodists across the street from the Baptists and the Presbyterians across the street from, you know, and I think it's still kind of that way. And then I think everybody was always jockeying for position for parking. So parking was a premium around the churches. It's broadened out. There's been, you know, there's through manufacturing and there's a lot of foreign direct investment and management teams coming in our area. So there was a really unique blend of like, you know, there'd be like Korean kids at our school and there'd be German kids at our school. We had a foreign exchange student stay with us when I was a kid. He was going to high school and my mom kind of got embedded with it and, you know, got in the mix and he actually stayed with us for a while. And then there was a teacher from Japan that we kind of, you know, adopted and brought into our family. I got a pretty good look at like the international broader landscape as a young kid without ever having left. And I didn't actually leave until like, you know, 23 years later.
So we had Mike Way, CEO, on the podcast. He had a colorful childhood. And it's interesting when you look at some of the guys who become SEALs and then go into the business world, found companies, VC backed. You might not think that they'd have childhoods like that. Did you have yourself a pretty colorful childhood?
That was a mess. That was an absolute mess. Like, and then the more that they tried to control it, the more rebellious they got, right? Being a father now myself, and I see kids and knowing how I grew up, I see their need to be outside. I see their need to run around. I see their need not to be like feral, like wild animals, right? Like we're not trying to find a place for our kids to like go chew on a deer in the backyard or something. But I see the need for kids to like just be in nature, be outside, explore. You know, that was something that I personally needed. I needed engagement. I needed more than 30 minutes of recess a day. I needed kind of that Montessori environment from school. And it's, you know, stuff didn't exist, right? Pre-K, elementary, middle school, high school, and it's all, you know, sit in a room, study, be quiet, raise your hand. And for me, I was a very active child, very active today in my current life. I need engagement and I need to get that out. I need to do it before I can settle and focus. Mm-hmm. And growing up, we didn't really get that. So I got into a lot of trouble because I made my own engagement.
What was the Underwear model before or after you on Unsolved Mysteries?
So when I was a kid, I was probably like 8 to 10. I don't remember how old. My mom had gotten in touch with whatever, I don't even know how, maybe like through friends or something, with a talent agency that was in Knoxville, Tennessee. And again, you know, Knoxville's not like even a mid-sized city, it's a small-sized city, but they had a talent agent there. And the lady that ran it was, I think, former Miss Tennessee. So she was like, she was kind of in that mix. And then she took over the agent position and was just, you know, business lady through and through. We got in contact with her when I was a kid and tried to work with her. So they do all the different things. So from a talent agency, they do voiceovers, they do acting, they do modeling, they do all this stuff. And I did some stuff when I was a kid. So like,
how old are we talking?
I mean, like 10.
Wild.
One thing I did was like a bike safety video for schools.
I didn't even know any of this. This is great.
I liked it because I got to leave school and go do this stuff. Anyways, companies come in and they go to these talent agents and they say, we have these projects. Do you have talent? So like my thing was, you know, I could like ride a mountain bike really well. So they did this whole like bike safety course on me riding my bike. Like I'd be riding down the street. They would open up a door and I would have to slam on my brakes and show them how to appropriately do this. So I did this stuff as a kid and I got paid really well. I mean, like to do the bike safety video, it was like a few thousand dollars. And as a kid to do that stuff, that was pretty impactful. I've never gravitated towards like, you know, a 9-to-5 job. I worked construction for a while, did roofing and waterproofing and all these different construction jobs. And it was just, man, it was a kind of eye-opener to what real work was like. It was more of like a summertime thing. It wasn't like a full-time jobs and positions. And I went to college. And when I would come back from college, my dad had since left the sales industry and was pretty entrepreneurial in his approach. He was trying to use kind of what he knew about the retail business and do something regionally within our region. Didn't really see what they were trying to do, so I didn't enjoy it. And I didn't want to get a job. I was like, well, I did this stuff when I was a kid. Maybe I can go re-engage with that lady and see what's available. And, you know, obviously come back, you're not a kid anymore. I was playing college football at 21, 22 yeah. years old, had put on some size. And she was like, you should try modeling. And I was like, okay, seems pretty socially awkward.
Not 9-to-5.
Yeah. It's not 9-to-5. And she told me that the money that I could make doing it, you have to build a card. You have to build like essentially your CV or whatever. I didn't have any money. She funded me the money to go do this shoot. And I show up and there's this guy there that he was previously in New York. He worked for her and then got picked up by a talent agent in New York. And he was making crazy money. Like he went full model, was making all this money, and he got into this is the story I was told. He got into a terrible car accident and actually, I think, killed a family as he was driving too fast in this car that he purchased with all this money that he was making. But he came back and he was like trying to get back into the industry. But I showed up and this guy, not an ounce of body fat on him. And he was like a good looking dude. And I was like, dang. Maybe I should try acting. And so, like, I was like, damn. So I was like, the whole time I was doing this shoot, trying to build this card, I was super self-conscious because like he had like the poses and the looks. And I'm just like, yeah, I'd like flexed in the mirror a couple of times. I did that and then started kind of building some traction in the industry and paid really well. And I didn't have to get a job.
Not a bad gig. What did you actually want to do when you were a kid compared to let's take that point from what you wanted to do to the first moment you realized you wanted to become a SEAL? How did that evolve?
I wanted to be a marine biologist. I actually did an internship out of high school. Education didn't come naturally to me. And those types of educational pursuits, you know, you have to be on your game. I started those courses like, nope, this isn't happening. I always had a draw to the water. I grew up competitively swimming. And I think that kind of draw to the water, when I made the decision to go to the military, kind of helped me craft towards, you know, the position that I did.
How old were you when you thought about the military?
I'm like 6 months before I went in.
Oh my God. So early 20s.
I enjoy adventure. Like I remember, you know, in high school, I would just try to make stuff up, like no money, no equipment, no resources. And we would swim out to islands and the lake and then like try to do survival week or whatever in the summer times. And I was always searching for that. And I lived in a pretty siloed community and, you know, didn't know how to exercise it in the way that I wanted to. So I always felt underserved in that position. And then I remember when the idea of going to the military actually stuck with me and like came in as a viable option. I was like, that is the adventure that I was seeking. And so my jump into the military was like kind of twofold, right? It's like what I discovered after I got in, which is completely different than what I thought it would be. I was seeking an adventure, you know, and it could have been anything. But I wanted it to be bigger. Like I wanted it to be something that had a little bit of weight to it. And going into the military was that.
Did you want to do the military or become a SEAL? Like, was there a specific want in the military?
SEAL. That was the adventure that I wanted. There was no other option. When I looked at the landscape, I was like, forever, ADD-driven kid, like, one day I get to wake up and scuba dive. The next day I get to wake up and like shoot guns. The next day I get to wake up and jump out of planes. I was like, that's phenomenal.
Do you go straight to Buzz? You have the SEAL Challenge contract?
Yeah. So when I was coming through, I think you guys were maybe the first class. You're
in Chicago, pre-Buzz?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were the one right after you guys. Prior to your class, people would come into the Navy and they would have to pick up a rate. And the special operator wasn't a rate. So they'd have to pick up a rate. They'd have to go to their A school. And A school is, you know, Master of Arms or Corpsman.
Your specialty in the Navy.
Your specialty in the Navy that would now be your job. And then you go to try to apply to go to BUDS, which is SEAL training. So when you came in, 271, it was the first time that they were actually making the SO rating a thing. And then when I came in, a year later, that process was still being refined. I came in with a contract. I threw up on my first PST.
You put out. So you get the buzz. What would you say your the best moment of buzz was? What was a moment of revelation or a moment that made you think it was all worth it? The best moment from buzz you could articulate?
Every day. I love training. It's because you wake up and it's like, hey, if I do this, this, and this, I will have a successful day. And there's somebody that's there kind of guiding you through it. So I loved sport. And I think sport was kind of driven the same way. So you show up to practice, you've got your individual drills that you do. And then, you know, you do those and then show your ability to excel at those. And then you have a successful day. So training was, there was no ambiguity there. It was, if I show up to this thing and do what they tell me to do, like Forrest Gump style, like, why did you do that so well? Because you told me to. I could be successful there. And something that weeds out that pipeline early on in the process is physical attributes. I've always been very physical. So to me, that kid running around that was told to be quiet, like, that wasn't the environment, right? That was, I got to be in an environment where I got to do exactly what I should be doing. And that's running around with my buddies and being physical. And so the whole time I loved it. So I did really well. I was second time every time and pretty much everything. Didn't get a medical role. I was very fortunate to make it all the way through. The tread was the only thing that came up that I was like, this is going to end me. And which sucked because we had guys in our class that like made bets with the instructors that didn't do it with fins. And
I can't even imagine. So yeah. The second phase is the dive phase in buds. And the selection isn't quite over there. You still have to pass some tests. And the tread is a purely physical test.
That's it.
It's 5 minutes of treading water with 80-pound tanks.
Yep.
With yeah. Fins and both hands above the water. If water goes above your wrist, you fail. So, I mean, you talk about what that 5 minutes was like.
So before I jumped in to do mine, one of the guys in our class, he's the fastest guy in our class. He played college soccer. He was lightning fast in 4 mile time runs. He was always first. This guy gets in to do his tread and he just makes up his mind. I'm going to do what I do on everything. I'm just going to put out. It's going to be fine. So I hear him. You can't face the other guys behind you. You have to face away. And I hear them jump in, and then about 3 minutes in, the noises that I heard, like things just went south for him really quickly, like an injured animal and a bunch of wild beasts just coming out. And then you just hear them all come around him. He's gargling and drowning and like his, you know, he's just having the worst time. And then he goes out. So like he, you know, inhales water, goes out. They bring him up out on the pool deck and we're, you know, like, what's going on? And look over and they, you know, he's out and they, the hand of life, they smack him. He comes back up, coughs up some water. And he was trying to put out so hard because that's how, what he knew from running. His legs just started kicking again, like he was still trying to go, which is awesome because that's the quality of human that goes to that program. Is like he was out. And the only thing that was stopping him from trying was because he was literally unconscious.
I'm still alive, therefore I'm going to keep kicking.
Right. Yeah. Right. So then I'm like, all right, I'm going next. I didn't practice, didn't train anything. Thought that I had it and got humbled really quickly. I got in the water, and again, probably about the 3-minute mark, my legs locked up, brought my hands down, had people come around me, shove me into water, splash me in the face. Then after the 5 minutes, you have to swim to the other side of the pool and then swim back. And that whole travel, anytime that I would feel like a moment of comfort was about to happen, just pull you right back underwater. It was worse than like, you know, the duration of Hell Week for me. I was like, man, I don't know if I don't know if that's actually a thing for me. Like, I don't know if I can do that. Luckily, there were some rollbacks that just worked with us. And then I came back and, you know, changed my technique, had some more information and did really well. But holy crap, that was a challenging environment.
So every day you love about Buds. And what's funny about Buds is every single day has failure built into it. You will fail something every single day. So it's almost like an incubator for entrepreneurship, for the business world. Every single day something's going to go wrong.
Yeah.
And hopefully it's something different at least, so you don't get bored of the same failure again and again. So what was it about the failure that you liked? How did you use it to iterate and make yourself better marginally at least every single day?
I think the end goal is kind of the driver for, you know, for that program. And then obviously the lesson of life is that, you know, setting goals and knowing what you're working towards makes all that stuff a great, you know, transition, and it makes you be able to go to bed at the end of the day satisfied and full and wake up hungry. I think people come to those experiences on their own in a variety of different ways. I think that pipeline is beautiful in the sense that it really exposes that in a very condensed time frame, and it allows you to express it and then have the confidence. I think the hard part, and then, you know, from veterans that get out, especially, you know, soft operators, is continuing to find it in a way that is fulfilling to them. You're surrounded by failure and like ultimate intensity, but there's always this greater goal that you're working towards. And man, it's really a beautiful thing. Like that whole pipeline. I don't know that there's another option for me outside of entrepreneurship. The idea of finding a big problem, building a team around it, and then just starting to hack away at it and like realizing that you're really good at something, I'm really good at something, this person's really good at something, and then defining that, it's a good thing. And there's challenges along the way understanding those things, but it's ebbs and flows, right? And being able to take those failures and turn them into successes.
So you endure the beautiful misery of Buds, SEAL selection, you make it to the SEAL teams for you and I meet. Let's condense your time in the teams down to what was the best aspect of the teams, the best moment of the teams, your favorite memory.
I'd section it out in two things. So in real time, in the moment, I'd say, again, the training. It's just so good, man. And then in reflection, I can appreciate the deployments, right? And preparing for those moments and then getting to those moments and then being like, this is the kind of accumulation of all of that, what I just did, and then the application of it. And it's humbling, it's exciting, it's terrifying. Those are kind of the two buckets I would put those two things in.
How about on deployment? So like you and I did two deployments together. We saw the full spectrum of mission types. What would you say your favorite style was? Was it direct action, the guerrilla warfare? Like what was it and why?
If I were to go through of like boxes that I wanted to check, I would say that a lot of those boxes were checked. They weren't checked multiple times, but they were checked. On deployment, I think my favorite kind of things to engage with, my first one we did all flyaways, meaning I would go get on a helicopter, I would go get dropped off somewhere, I would sit in that place for 2 days, I would get picked up by a helicopter and come back. I remember my team lead at the time talking to me about mortgages, and like he gave me like a financial education on, because he you know, he's already married, had kids, bought houses, and you know, had investments and stuff. And I literally learned through like, you know, what a mortgage rate was and how to take out a mortgage on a home on top of a mountaintop in a third world country. So those moments were like really, really special. And just, you know, kind of the day-to-day nuances. Life exists differently when you're in an environment like that. The ones that I didn't like the most were walking around in the middle of the night with me and four other guys for, you know, miles and miles, and knowing that in the environment I was walking around in, at any given point in time, I could lose a leg. That was very stressful. And you and I both know guys that have experienced that. Just knowing that that was a thing was tough. It made it hard to like focus on the next step. So I think there's a lot of stuff that you've got to kind of plow down just to move forward in those environments, which is also, again, kind of a beautiful thing. Wow. In reflection, thinking about that, you know, it's very fortunate that we're sitting here today without any potential injuries that could have taken place or were very near in taking place.
What was the point at which you knew you were not going to make the military career and you were thinking about getting out?
The adventure of a career aspect and doing what I had done a couple of times did not seem appealing at all. Not to say that I wasn't fulfilled on the idea of like going to war and being a combatant and stuff. I was, but I was also done. What's interesting in that community is a lot of times people consider it as quitting too. You know, you do 6 years and get out. That's a real thing. Like, people were like, you didn't finish your career there. You quit. It took a while to like, no, I was done. I didn't want to do it anymore. I wanted to do a different adventure.
So like, what's found out of the Navy before, between that and between 2018 when you founded Zero Eyes, what did you get into and what was your transition like? The psychological part, the emotional part, the experiential part?
Yeah. So when I got out, I did have a bit of a plan. I wanted to finish college. I applied to some colleges while I was getting out of the military, and they pretty much all came back to me and were like, A, your transcripts are terrible. And B, you should take like a community college class and try to like show somebody some traction. It sucked. I had plans. I wanted to go to the University of Colorado and I wanted to move to Boulder. I wanted to get an education. Knowing that I need to do that, I started, what's the next steps? How do I figure this out? And a former SEAL in Nashville, Tennessee, he got me work. And I was looking at taking a job with them. And I was trying to build a nonprofit to go high peak every state in the United States, which is high peaking, if people aren't aware of it, is you go, you know, essentially stand at the top of every state and kind of bag that. I was looking in for an adventure and try to build some credentials in a space that I was interested in. And then I met my wife and I was like, you're the greatest adventure that I could take. That was over 10 years ago and we're still together and have a couple of kids. So good decision.
I want to just ask one question before you move on to the business world, but you were an instructor for a little bit, going back to BUDS in third phase, which is the land warfare phase. Did you get to work a Hell Week?
I met my wife. I didn't know what I was going to do next. I literally moved in with her with a truck and my dog and no job. So that's how my wife brought me in. I didn't know what I was going to do. So I started poking around. Okay, what jobs are guys like me getting? No college degree, former experience in the military, and, you know, got kind of roped into the contracting world. I did some trips overseas doing protection on a few different things and, you know, made some money, generated some traction. And I got word of a company that had contracting jobs for BUDS instructors. And I was like, man, that seems like something that I could do, that I could, you know, kind of build myself in the workforce, support that organization. And then the idea was to maybe even be able to grow up in that organization too, not just be on the contractor side, but get over into the business side. And I literally emailed the founder of that company probably every week for 6 months.
Oh, really?
Or 8 months.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then I just moved to California. And then when I got to California, I sent him an email. I was like, hey, I moved to California. I'm in San Diego. If you need anything, let me know. At that time, they had some people roll out. And he was like, hey, let's meet. And we sat down and we met, we talked, and he gave me a job. So yeah, I took a third phase Buds instructor position, and it was awesome. Like it was great, man. Like some things that I missed out on from being in the teams, I got to like re-engage, like throw a grenade again. I was like, I never thought I was going to do this again. And here I am getting a team of individuals like that, like the Bud students, and then giving them constructive direction and seeing what they can accomplish in such a short time frame. It was like, holy crap. And I did work a hell week. I worked a couple of hell weeks.
So before you do it, like part of the theme of this podcast is how do you iterate your way to success, whether it's in the military or in business, entrepreneurship. And like, there's a lot of wisdom in the SEAL selection process. Then when you're going through it, it's just kind of pain. And you might have a vague idea, but you actually got to see it from the other side.
Sure.
So from that view, what did like Buds and then zooming in specifically at a hell week look like as an iterative process for the people going through it to get them to a certain goal, to get them to a certain toughness or a certain realization? How did that look like?
A lot of reflection of your own experience through it, and then being able to capture that, apply it to your experiences that you had in training and combat, and then, you know, mold that into them whenever you can, because a lot of times they're just checked out. When you get those moments where you can actually get eye contact with them and make eye contact, it's okay, what am I going to give this individual to be able to like prepare them for the next step that they take? A lot of the times it was using the moment or the experience, whether it be like a surf passage that they were doing, or whether it be them being on a log, just taking those moments of failure and be like, here's why you failed and why that failure is actually a success to you. I remember a student, young kid, probably just came out of high school, probably used to mouthing off everybody around him, didn't have, you know, a social structure in that sense or awareness. And he mouthed off to one of the instructors in those environments, in those training environments, it's not about you, it's about the team. So if you mess up, the team messes up, not you.
I think I remember this is such a good story about cause and effect, about repercussions and consequences.
Yeah.
Yeah, talk about it. This is great.
So, you know, when you mess up in those environments, the team gets punished, not you. Traditionally, in that phase of training, it's not about you as an individual performer anymore. It's about the team. That whole class ended up, for lack of a better way to put it, getting beat, I guess, for quite a bit of time while that student stood there and watched his class.
So he was not getting beaten. His entire class was getting beaten for his failure.
Exactly. Physically, you know, not like beaten with like sticks and stuff, but like burpees or like whatever, sprints or whatever. So yeah, they were paying physically for his mistakes, which ultimately is worse, right? Like then you walk around with that within your class. Mind you, I would like to fast forward. I saw this kid in the next stage of his training. Awesome. He was locked on. He was leading a group of kids that were, you know, focused on their task and what they're doing. So this isn't like a torture thing or whatever.
Well, this is probably why he was able to achieve that state.
Exactly.
After spending his whole life mouthing off at everybody he ever came across.
And you can't go into those moments softly. You have to learn those moments, and they have to be ingrained in you. Now, when you get on to later phases of training, I think that kind of relaxes a little bit, because the expectation is that, okay, like we all are professionals now, let's build each other. Like if you fall a little bit, that's all right, man, let's go. And so I remember sitting down with his class after that whole thing. It was like, we all knew that it was bad. Like we all knew it was bad. And I remember sitting down with those guys and being like, guys, what's the definition of a good gift? And, you know, nobody said anything. I was like, something that you want, but you're not going to get for yourself. And that's what we just gave you. And like, as messed up as that sounds, what we were able to do is create a base for them for when they actually get into a real situation and they get into an environment that's terrible, that they can go back to and go, it's not as bad as that was. You know, like it can be worse. Like I could be cold and sandy and wet and terrible and miserable and hate all my friends. It's not that bad. So then that gives you the space to feel safe. And when you're safe, you can make decisions. and you can take steps. And then that was the position that we tried to take as an instructor staff.
I love it. Let's fast forward to Zero Eyes. So did you have any sort of crisis of meaning during your transition? And if so, did that happen to coincide with the moment Mike, our current CEO of Zero Eyes, reached out to you with this idea of Zero Eyes, of stopping mass shootings? Like, when did he reach out to you and how did that impact you?
We kept in touch with Mike the whole time. So I guess there's about a 5-year period where, you know, once every 6 months or so, we would touch base. I think Mike helped me with my resume a couple of times. Mike was my LPO in Buds, my leader in Buds. And Mike has a certain draw to him that I haven't seen in anybody else. Mike truly walks around with something that's special. Like, there's something about him. Mike went to actually have a conversation with the development of the technology and like what it could be. And he came back from that conversation and was like, I think we can do this. And when Mike said that, like, it could have been literally digging ditches for a living. Like, it was a no-brainer for me. It was a good friend move. It was a good career move. It was a good, like, exercise for adventure. And I needed that. So when Mike really started to put some gas on, I was like, okay, we're doing something. Like, something is happening. And I remember the first time coming up to Philly to kind of workshop it. And then in reflection and knowing what I know about entrepreneurship now, it doesn't matter what the product is or what the software is or whatever. It's the team. Do you have the team? Do you have the team to get the next steps? And it's not always going to be the right team through all phases, but like, do you have a team to get started? To me, adventure, team, trust, like these things started to line up. And I was like, all right, like, let's go. All in.
In the middle of Zero Eyes, you actually got your MBA. And I kind of want to drill in on that one because like advice from everybody here is don't waste your time. You did it. And your growth from that MBA was literally tangible. Like, it was almost instantaneous. Do you have anything you want to share about the MBA, the quality of it, comparing the business school versus what you learned in the real world, maybe how the two coincided with each other? Run with it however you want.
We had not paid ourselves or taken a paycheck or, you know, done literally the sleeping founder's basement thing for 12 months, maybe more. And we had just taken our first round of funding. The pandemic happened. I had my first kid and I started Vanderbilt MBA program all at once. You and Mike and Rob were kind of inspirational in the sense that, you know, I'd known you guys in the military. I had known what you guys could do. And we had worked together as peers and positions. And I remember starting Zero Eyes and being very under a position of being able to contribute in ways that, you know, business sense would be needed. But there was a language there that I just didn't know. So, you know, I had you guys to kind of look at that and be like, okay, you know, I've seen the transition with these guys too. And whether you guys think that you needed or you didn't, there was just a level of language that was there that didn't exist prior. I got the MBA, A, because, you know, we worked hard to be able to get sponsored, to be able to get a GI Bill and to be able to go educate and then be able to provide and build companies and provide jobs and stuff. Like, that's something that I took very personally. Like, I have this as a resource. Like, I'm going to do it. I might as well have gone and learned like Spanish for 2 years and then moved to South America, right? Like, I went and got an MBA. I learned that language. And when you can have a higher level conversation, you can go into deeper things. And when you can go into deeper things, you can really solve problems. And I didn't want there to be a barrier there. And it allowed me to draw on different resources and make decisions. And something that would have taken me years to sit down and like figure out which book I need to read or like which podcast I need to listen to or whatever, it condensed it and gave me an outlet that now I can work from.
Real quick, lightning round. 3 books and or 3 movies you think everybody should read and or watch?
We'll go movies first. So Tombstone, Fight Club's one of my favorite movies. I'll come back to the third one. Books. I just read Green Lights by Matthew McConaughey. I think the guy's super interesting. And somebody that like just takes chances and moves forward. So he has a really good book. all the books that I've read recently are literally about business and venture capital and entrepreneurship. So like,
let's name one.
Mastering the VC Game or Secrets of Sand Hill Road. Those were really fun, just talking about, you know, cap tables and entrepreneurs from the venture capital perspective. I think they give a good insight on like, hey, I know you feel this way, but like all companies in your stage feel this way. So like, it'll be okay. And then third movie, Ninja Turtles 1.
Ninja Turtles 1. All right. It's a good way to finish it.
That's it for this episode. If you want to check out more from the podcast, head to zeroeyes.com/Nobel, where you can see show notes, read more about our guests, and suggest guests or topics of your own. Until next time, stay in the fight. Don't ring the bell.